Hi, I'm Leah Lane, an award-winning travel writer and author of Places I Remember, Tales, Truths, Delights from 100 Countries. On this podcast, we share conversations with travelers about fascinating destinations and memorable experiences around the world. Places I Remember focuses on destinations, travel topics, and often inspiring stories of people, places, and experiences from travel around the world. For example, in episode 21, we talked with Jim Davidson, who was climbing Everest when there was the strongest earthquake ever in Nepal, and he summited. In episode 20, we talked with actor Stephen Bishop and his mother, Leslie, about the realities of traveling during the Jim Crow era and now as Black travelers. In episodes 14 and 15, my son Randall, chief content editor of Forbes, told stories of his extreme adventures from Liberia to Syria to running with the bulls in Pamplona. This episode's incredible story features Deanne Birch, an author who suffered tragedy and dealt with primitive conditions living on a remote barrier island off Alaska's Arctic coast over 50 years ago. Deanne's new memoir about this experience is Journey Through Fire and Ice, Shattered Dreams Above the Arctic Circle. Welcome, Deanne.
Thank you.
Well, I read your memoir. I couldn't put it down. You managed to not only tell a harrowing story, but also give us a real sense of place about a desolate island and a stoic people living above the Arctic Circle. Before we get to your big adventure, let's start by talking a bit about your life before. You were born and raised in Canada and attended the University of Toronto. Tell us a bit about Canada in the 1950s and 60s.
Well, it was certainly, we were just on the edge. At least Toronto was just on the edge of being a really great city. Theaters had started to open up and there were wonderful restaurants. And it was a place that I was very sorry to leave. However, I do have a summer home just 120 miles above Toronto. So I get to Toronto occasionally. I haven't been there for a couple of years because of the pandemic. I love it.
What is that lake's name? What is the lake's name?
Lake Muskoka. It's a beautiful area. And I finally got there this summer after last summer. It was first time in 54 years that I hadn't gone there. So this summer, it was definitely a treat for me to get there and be part of, you know, be part of my friends and my life up there.
Is it still as beautiful as you remembered?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I probably thought it was even more beautiful because I hadn't been there for a year. But yes, and my friends were all there.
Right.
It was an incredible experience just being there.
Some of the things you mentioned I relate to. You had a long honeymoon in Europe. And in the book, you mentioned some of your favorite places that you remember on that trip and how it affected you. Can you share a couple of memories of your honeymoon and tell us about it?
I guess really, I have so many places that I loved when we went on our honeymoon, probably, which isn't even mentioned in my memoir, was going to Norway because I had a friend that lived there and she and her husband owned a moose preserve. So we had the most wonderful moose for dinner one night. It tasted so much better than roast beef.
Really?
And it was just a treat being in Norway. I loved all the places we were. I think probably because I'm of Scottish descent, I loved Scotland and I would love to go back there.
Well, I hope you do. It's all those places you're talking about are beautiful. Your memoir focuses on the summer of 1964 when you were 23 years old and you accompanied your husband Tiger to the remote Inuit island village of Kavalina, Alaska. Tiger was conducting a study of the people there and you, Deanne, were a city girl. You write that you're unprepared for what you were about to experience. You wrote that you thought you would instinctively adapt to this difficult way of life and you seemed to think that love would conquer all. How did that work out?
It didn't. I think I thought that when we went up there that we were going on an adventure together. And he was so immersed in his work that I found it very difficult to really adapt. And also, of course, he wanted me to do everything that we call them now Inuit, but at that point we did refer to them as Eskimos. And they even referred to themselves as Eskimos at that point. But he wanted me to do everything that the women up there did. I had to cut up the seals and render the blubber into seal oil. had to dry the fish and cut up, clean and cut up and dry the fish. Basically, I did everything that the Native women did. And I tried to adapt. It was very difficult because they were always very suspicious of white women who came to the village. Tiger said that they were so used to women saying that they were dirty and, you know, just lived in little shacks. And I guess in a way that's true. Their houses were very small, very small. They were all one room houses, with the exception of our house. I felt that perhaps I was the lucky one. I was living like a queen compared to the rest of the villagers.
Well, you wrote in the book of Waking Up from a Dream, colors of Catalina were an echo of my life there. The grays mirrored my loneliness and isolation. The soft whispers of pink mauve offered my fragments of hope. What are some of the reasons that, beyond what you said, that it didn't work out? The difficulty, for example, of going back home. You wrote there were 4 plane trips to get home and no phones, and the news came by mail every 10 days. Did that really affect you every day? You thought about that kind of thing?
Well, I think I was really lonely. I missed my family. My first niece was about to be born, and I had been asked to be godmother, but I had to turn it down because I didn't think it was fair, because originally we were going to be away for 2 years, and I just didn't think I could be a good godmother to her, so I turned that down. And I just missed being at home. It was very difficult being in a land that in a culture that I knew nothing about. And yet I think gradually I began to adapt to the culture. I know it was difficult. Just as I was really adapting to the culture, of course, my husband, then the tragedy hit.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. But just, I was reading, you were having situations that most of us can't imagine. There was no plumbing. There was no running water, and electricity wasn't available in your home. So give us a few specifics about that. What was that like?
The plumbing was a little difficult because we had a shack. We lived in a house, but of course the toilet wasn't inside the house. It was in a storage room outside. So every time we had to use the toilet, we had to go outside and go into the shack, or at least into the storage room where it was. And that was a little difficult because, of course, you had to put on your parka to get outside.
You're right that it's 30 below Fahrenheit sometimes. Yes, there.
Sometimes it wasn't that cold, but a lot of the time it was. So living without plumbing for me was very difficult. I was kind of a modest person. It was just a very difficult thing. Living without electricity was probably more difficult for me, because when Tiger wasn't home, I had to light the kerosene lanterns. And as a child, I had always been terrified of fire. For some reason, I used to dream that I was in the lake and I was surrounded by fire. I don't know whether it was a premonition of what was going to happen in my life, because, of course, we did end up in that kind of a situation in a way. I would put off lighting the kerosene lanterns as long as I could, because I was afraid that I was going to get burned by the kerosene lantern.
Right. Now, tell us about some of the foods you ate that you had to eat while you were there.
Actually, we did eat a lot of canned food. We had one night I didn't know what to cook, and I had been cutting up seals all day, and all of a sudden inspiration hit. I thought, oh, I know what I can do. I can cut up the seal liver for dinner. So fortunately, no bacon, but we did have onions, and I cooked up some kind of rotten, well, they were not the best onions. They had started to sprout, but I cut up the onions. I fried the liver, and believe it or not, the liver was better than cow's liver.
Really? Cow.
Yeah, it was very, very good.
I remember I traveled to Greenland, and I went to a market, and I saw the seal liver all over, and I spoke to people who ate it, and they said it took the place very often of vegetables. There were so few vegetables, the vitamins in the liver were similar, and it was very important to eat that.
We also, of course, if we went on a trip, we would take along dried fish and seal oil, because that was what would keep us warm on the trip. Certainly wasn't my favorite kind of food, but it did keep us warm, and it was easy to transport.
Tell us about some of your camping trips. That was very interesting to read about.
Well, the first camping trip we went on was in the summer. We went up to a place called Cape Thompson, which was an absolutely beautiful place. And we had taken along dried fish and seal oil to eat and taken along our two dogs with us. And we got up to the Cape and we realized that we couldn't stay there because there were so many waves that we were afraid that our boat was going to drift away. When we were up there, on the way up, a person from the Arctic lab beckoned us in. We had the best lunch since we had left home. We had everything. It was wonderful food. And then on our way back, we were beckoned in again by the same people. They gave us 3 or 4 steaks to take home with us, which was just a real treat because we hadn't eaten steaks. And of course, they gave us fresh fruit. And I said to Tiger, I feel like we're charity cases. But he certainly didn't feel that way. He was thrilled to have the steaks. That was a wonderful experience. And the Cape Thompson was absolutely beautiful. There were birds up there that were nesting on the ledges. It was just a fabulous experience. We also went on a kind of a camping trip. It was called Fish Camp. And that was different because the woman and I that were there did all the cooking for the men. And the men would come in hungry and they'd eat separately. And I think I said in my memoir that one night there was no talking, there was no laughter. And I said to Sarah, what's going on? And Sarah put her hand to her mouth and she shook her head. That night when Tiger came into the camp, he said, we think we heard the Inukun, which were wild, the wild people up there, considered the wild people. So we sat with our backs against the tent. And then he said, do you hear anything right now? And I said, no, but I guess really they had been visited by the wild people. And that to me was a little bit scary because I didn't want to go out of the tent. I was afraid that the wild people were going to be around. I was also afraid of bears and I was afraid of many things. So basically Sarah and I stayed in the tent the whole time, unless we had to go outside to relieve ourselves. So that was quite an interesting experience. Our third camping trip, however, was the camping trip that was a total disaster.
Well, that's part of the story.
The third camping trip we went on was one day after Thanksgiving. And Tiger had decided that it would be nice for us to get away from the village. I kind of wondered why we weren't going someplace else. I thought, oh, you know, we could go outside. Maybe we could go to Anchorage. But no, if we went to Anchorage, I'd never want to come back to the village. We hitched up our dog team and we went 30 miles up the river to where Tiger had a fish cache up there. And on the way up, I was so cold that I thought my feet were going to freeze. And Tiger said, well, you have to get off the sled and you have to run a while. I guess I shouldn't have been so stupid, but he didn't tell me that. So I got off the sled and I ran a little bit and then I would get back on the sled. I was panting harder than the dogs were because it was very hard for me to keep up with the dogs. We got there and it was probably around maybe 2 in the afternoon and the sky was already a peach color and it was getting dark. So Tiger set up the tent as quickly as he could and we got warm and I took off my mukluks and started to warm up my feet. And he said, well, let's go out for a walk. And so I put on my mukluks. And just as we got to the door, we heard a dog team. And we thought we were going to be alone for those 3 nights that we were up there. But oh no, the first night, one of the villagers arrived and said, I didn't bring my camping gear, but is it okay if I stay here for the night? And I thought, oh no, there goes our steak dinner. So we're going to have to get out the fish and we're going to have to get out the seal oil, which we did. And Tiger, actually, he was kind of happy that this visitor had arrived because I think he knew that he was going to learn all kinds of things. In the meantime, our tent was kind of at the top of a bluff. And finally, when we were just about getting ready for bed, I decided I better go out and relieve myself. And I fell down the bluff and it was perfect snow for snow angels. But of course, I didn't feel like making snow angels at that point. And I walked up and they laughed at me. I felt like the abominable snowman. But honestly, I wondered if in the middle of the night, the same thing happened and they were sound asleep, what would happen to me? And the next morning, Bobby took off and I thought, oh, good. Now we're going to have a nice day together. So Tiger went out and worked on his fish cache for a while. And I just kind of stayed in the tent and kept warm. And then Tiger decided that we would take a moonlight walk. And I said, oh, good, that's great. I'd love to do that. So we left the house and all of a sudden another dog team arrived. And this time it was another person from the village. And I guess they just really wanted to come up and see what we were doing. I don't know, but that's my impression. Lowell stayed that night. And I actually, by that point, I was really frustrated. So I just sat in the tent and I sulked because we had to eat the fish and seal oil again. And that wasn't what we had planned at all. Well, the third day, Lowell left in the morning and Tiger said, let's go ice fishing. And I said, I don't really know if I want to go ice fishing. It's really, really cold. By this time, it was probably 30 or 35 below. And he said, oh, come on, it's going to be fun. So we went up. We really didn't do any ice fishing at all because I got too cold. And on our way back, we ran into four of the natives who were camped further up the river. It's a good job we ran into them. Tiger talked to them for a while and asked them if Lowell or Bobby went up. And they said, nobody's going to visit your campsite tonight because it's going to be too cold. In fact, we almost decided to leave, but we're staying on for a few days. So Tiger and I went back to the tent and he tried to turn on the Coleman stove and the stove was plugged. By this time, I think it was probably maybe around 6 at night. So we worked for an hour trying to fix the stove. And he couldn't fix the stove. So he said, well, we're not going to survive the night. So what I'm going to do is we had another little tent with us. He said, I'm going to make a teepee out of the tent and we're going to be fine. We'll just light a fire in the teepee. And he said, but whatever you do, don't let your arm or don't let your foot or whatever it was go into the teepee. So he's standing there and his foot goes into the teepee. And of course, our tent burned up and it burned up all around us and we were left with nothing. So he said, well, we're going to have to go upriver. It's the only way we're going to survive. And so we started to load the tent and all of a sudden my knee went out on me and that had not happened to me since high school. I couldn't believe that would happen. Poor Tiger had to load me onto the sled with the sleeping bags on top of me to keep warm. And we hoped that we would find the way up there. And for a while, we knew we were on the right trail, but all of a sudden we realized that we had lost the trail. Finally, we got on the right trail again, and we did arrive at the natives' campsite, and they didn't even wake up when we got there. We just kind of climbed over the beds and put our sleeping bag down, went to sleep. But the next morning I woke up and I was so sick, so we had to stay at the campsite until we could go home. And our trip home was sort of interesting. All of a sudden, a wind blew and the dogs were being pulled across the sheer ice. And finally, we made it to the other side. And I was never so glad in all my life to see the kerosene lanterns that were flickering. I almost wondered if it was a dream at that point. But we got home and one of the women came over to see how we had survived the camping trip. And of course, she saw I was freezing cold. So she said, I'm going to pull up my parka and my dress. And so she put my feet on her belly to keep me warm, which was another way, I guess, that the natives survived. I also learned later that they buried themselves under the snow to keep warm and had a little air hole and hoped that somebody would come along and rescue them. I couldn't have done that.
Well, a few days later, a real disaster struck and you had the ice part for the first disaster and the fire part for the second, which you want to talk about?
Well, I guess it was 6 days after our fateful camping trip, which we really did think it was fateful. We were sitting around and I was getting ready to cook dinner. And I really thought that I was holding Tiger back. And I talked to him a little bit and he said, well, for a while, I think you were, but he said, you survived that camping trip so well that I think you could survive anything at this point. And so then he said, do you want to go to Anchorage after Christmas? Oh my God. I was so excited. I couldn't believe that he would want to take me to Anchorage. And I was busy fantasizing just what our trip was going to be like. I then told him that it was time to have dinner. And I was still fantasizing about it when he tried to light the Coleman lantern and the fumes blew up in his face. And he got me out of the house. He obviously went back in to save his notes. But his rendition of the whole thing was that he ran in to save his notes and he ran through a wall of fire with his hands over his face. Now, I know in my heart of hearts that he was burned initially when that fire blew up in his face, because when his hands were very badly burned and his ears sloughed off. So unfortunately, of course, we were without medical help. So finally, I stood outside and I screamed. I didn't know what else to do. I think I was in my stocking feet and I just stood there. I was frozen to the ground and I screamed. Finally, a young kid came along and he ran to get help. And there was so much smoke in the house that they had to go back to the armory and get gas masks in order to get into the house. In the meantime, I had run around to the back, really not thinking, because I could have possibly started the fire again. I had known when I was outside that if I went in, that probably the whole house would burn down. I don't know how I knew that. Maybe it was just gut instinct. I could see Tiger through the window, and I knew I had to go in. I just knew I did, even though the room was so full of smoke. I ran in, and I wondered if he was dead. And I think he was waiting to die when the men took him out of the building. And the first place they took him was over to the minister's house. Mildred Sage, the postmistress, she came over in all the smoke, grabbed my Eddie Bauer parka, and rushed me over to where the minister was. By this time, there was a whole bunch of people there praying, and I really didn't want them there. I wanted to be alone. Then the men took Tiger over to the schoolhouse, where he was laid on a mattress, and I was there. And I guess the nurse was there too. And they didn't know very much about burns. And unfortunately, well, I mean, I understand why they didn't. So they were the chief people to look after Tiger. And every time he took a breath, I thought it was going to be his last breath. Finally, the school teacher tried to get through to Kotzebue to send a plane up, and he couldn't get through. And I said, what's wrong? Why can't a plane get through? Well, we can't get hold of them because it's so cold. Finally, they said that they would send a plane up as quickly as possible. I think it was around 10 o'clock that the plane arrived, and we had been without medical help for 17 hours. Wow. By this time, I thought, oh, thank God, as soon as they get to Kotzebue, they're going to be able to help them. So we was loaded on the plane. Oh, the whole village came behind us, which was really kind of wonderful. They were there to lend us their support. We got on the plane, landed in Kotzebue, and were taken by ambulance to the hospital. They took one look at him, and they said, he can't stay here. We have to send him to Anchorage. The doctor told me he didn't think Tiger was going to survive.
Well, I know this is a terrible ordeal even to discuss at this point, but I know he spent 3 months back in the mainland U.S. hospital receiving treatment for the burns, and then you returned to Catalina to complete the study that he started. You had the resilience, both of you, to come back. I know that these life-threatening and harrowing experiences transformed you, and you've learned how to embrace challenge, certainly. After the journey, you and Tiger eventually settled in Pennsylvania. You spent 30 years as a professional photographer. You taught and lectured. And since retiring in 2014, you've devoted yourself to writing short stories and children's stories. Now, Deanne, the name of the podcast is Places I Remember. You've given us many stories, but could you end by giving us one of your most special of all?
Well, probably my most special memory would be that I had the resilience to return to the village. That was all Tiger wanted to do. I didn't want to return. But when I did return, we were embraced by the whole community. So that probably is my most special memory of my time.
That's beautiful to think of, that you, after all of this and all of the difficulties, the connections were there. And people all over the world connect through situations that are difficult. And that's one of the wonderful things about travel, is the connection to the people. Do you know if climate change has affected the village?
They went to the government to ask for funds to relocate the village and were successful in doing this. And right now the school has been built. I believe that it is 12 miles upriver from where Catalina is. Apparently by 2025, Catalina will be underwater and will no longer exist.
Now that's a tragedy.
It is. You think of the people that have lived there for centuries and all of a sudden have to move because of climate change.
So thank you so much for sharing these amazing memories with us, Deanne. We can all become more resilient travelers if we open our hearts and embrace the challenges that are bound to come our way when we travel. Again, your book is Journey Through Fire and Ice, Shattered Dreams Above the Arctic Circle. Thanks again, and keep traveling.
Thank you.
Do you have a travel story worth sharing with Places I Remember listeners around the world? If you do, please contact me at the links I put at the end of each episode's show notes and on my website, placesiremembersleahlane.com. Tell me about your story, and I promise to get back to you, and maybe we'll talk on the podcast. Thanks for listening to our award-winning podcast. We've recorded over 100 episodes of Places I Remember, so follow us on any podcast app. And new monthly episodes are also on YouTube with gorgeous video. My book, Places I Remember, is available in print and Kindle, and I read the audio version. Follow my travel writing at Forbes.com. Contact me at the links in the show notes or on my website, placesiremembersleahlane.com, and keep making your own travel memories.